Coming up, writer, comedian Dana Gould joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. Hi, Tamara Berg. Nice to see you there.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm wonderful. I'm so excited. I'm giddy about getting to talk to Dana Gould. I'm a longtime fan of Dana's. We worked together many years ago on a show called Fired. He, of course, you know, went on. We're going to be reading his credits, but, of course, worked with The Simpsons and is known as the comedian's comedian, but just one of the funniest people ever. And I'm excited to talk. And he's a movie lover.
Yeah.
He's worked on TCM, Turner Classic Movies.
Excellent.
Did some hosting with Ben one night. You know, he has an affinity, as those who know him, with the film Planet of the Apes. We're going to get into that. But he's just a wonderful person.
I'm
excited.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to be, you know, when someone funny is on and you try to up your game.
Yes.
So I always watch. I'll sink now.
Just because you've said
that was funny.
That was hilarious.
That's like when you try to be funny around a comedian and they just stare at you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's not funny. Okay.
Okay, moving on.
All right. Well, nice to see you here.
Thank you. Nice to see you. Speaking of movies, we haven't really talked about this year's Oscar awards.
Yes, the it's great to have a wonderful debacle like that. It was completely. First of all, my night was crazy enough because I of all the things I had a meeting that day, a meeting about a project that I am directing.
Yes.
And they wanted a meeting.
They know it's a national holiday in Los Angeles?
I know.
Oscar
and
Day?
So we met at the Four Seasons and there was a party already going on. And so it was complete chaos.
Did you just crash that party after the meeting?
No, because I had to leave because I had to go to a viewing party at a friend's house. And I got to the viewing party and we're watching the Oscars and the salesman, and she goes up to make her speech and all the lights in the house go out.
No!
And it is complete.
That was a fantastic speech, by the way.
Well, we missed it. And no one had. We were in a screen. It was complete. We were like, is it the government? Is it the end of it? But to make our way out, and we had elderly people watching, so that became a whole thing. And then after 20 minutes, there was no, you know,
power did not come back on.
No, so people were starting to bail, and it was a shame too because I lost $5. We had the ballot
pool.
There in the pool. I lost my $5, but and then I go home, and then I was like, what a night, and then the debacle. But the idea that Warren Beatty, it just had everything of comedy, that it needed. It had Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway. My favorite part was apparently they were squabbling sort of backstage. So that's how great comedy.
The two of them.
Yeah, they were fighting. They were squabbling.
One another for the problem?
No. This is
oh, before.
Sidebar. That would have been a good story. Oh, that's funny. I heard an old married couple. They were grumbling at each other, you know, beforehand. So there's that backstory. Then you've got the backstory of Price Waterhouse, the guy that he's in love with Emma Stone.
Yeah.
And all he wants is a picture of Emma Stone and get literally hands, you know, the only thing he has
he was
to do.
Starstruck.
All he has to do is hand him the right envelope and somehow gives him the wrong envelope. Then you have like Emma Stone, like, do we blame Emma Stone? Then we have the producers of La La Land who give all their speeches and could have been a disaster, but yet they go, no, this award belongs to you. And they sort of save
the card.
So that guy makes himself famous overnight, the producer. Then we have Then Jimmy Kimmel, you know, the way he handled it, I thought was hysterical when he said, "What have you done, Warren?"
Warren Beatty, what have you done?
You know, then you have like the 11th, it's like the Zapruder film now. Everyone is examining the close up, and we're all become private detectives.
Right. So do you think all the hoopla was really warranted?
Absolutely. Yeah. Because it keeps us, well, that way we don't have to think about real things, like our real government. You know, it keeps it exciting. I mean, I'm a member of the Academy. I vote. It was an upset. I really thought La La Land was going to be a strong contender. They spilled the beans about something in the press that I don't think people know, which has been a recent change in the Academy, that you have to vote for a first, second, and third film.
Right.
And I'm wondering how that, again, maybe even affected, you know, there could be a further controversy of, you know, I'd like to see the actual votes. This brings up something interesting. Is can you see the actual votes?
Right. Do they ever release that information?
I don't know. Now I'm curious. And I actually vote. So, you know, how many people of the 6,000 members voted, you know, for those films? Did Fences and Moonlights, did they split the votes?
Right.
Because it seemed that part of the issue was that Faye Dunaway was so convinced that La La Land had won that it wasn't even a surprise. She was like, "Oh, Warren, La La Land." And she's like Gracie Allen. She's completely wrong. I love the way. And then Jimmy Kimmel the next day, in a very kind of Jack Parr way of explaining, bringing us all into it, what happened backstage and how Denzel Washington, they were wandering around the stage and he looked out and he said that Denzel Washington was telling him to get Barry Jenkins to give a speech, because then the poor Moonlight people didn't even get a speech. And then you have, you know, the post, like, they've got all the reaction. Did you see the Meryl Streep face?
And, yeah, everybody, like, so, well, like the Zapruder film, or the Martin Luther King, everybody pointing in the direction.
I wish we had this kind of enthusiasm for our government. Right? You know what I mean? The outrage, the drama, the comedy, the speculation. You know, meanwhile, like, our country is falling apart. And it's like, yeah, okay, whatever. Another one just got confirmed. When it comes to the Oscars, we're going to demand that something is right. But for Pricewaterhouse, it's a debacle.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, they should be gone. How could they ever be trusted again?
No, of course.
You know, I felt bad for the two people. Of course, you know, should they be fired? Probably. I mean, you know, who elected me king of Pricewaterhouse? But did the guy mess up? He did. But is that something that should have been handled privately, maybe between him and Pricewaterhouse?
Right.
But boy, the public scathing the guy has had.
Yeah.
Including, you know, oh, the guy self-proclaimed that he says he looks like Matt Damon. Like, okay, well, we've gotten to the bottom of it. Let's crucify him. You know, I feel sorry for them.
But a really important question I have for you.
The main thing is, I didn't win again.
You didn't win again.
And
which was your favorite dress? That's actually really what I'd like to talk about.
Emma Stone, I thought, had, in my opinion.
Oh, fantastic dress.
But God bless Halle Berry. I freaking loved it.
Did you?
Yes.
She was on a lot of worst dress lists for that.
I know, but, you know, screw them. They have no sense of humor. She's such a beautiful woman.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved her hair. I thought it was fantastic. It's fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun. She looked in the mirror and she was like, you know what? Let's do something crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
It was definitely out of the norm for her,
She's
for
so
sure.
beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, she could pull that off.
She could wear this mic cover on her head and look amazing.
So I thought she was great. But again, everybody is a little bit too styled. Everything kind of looks, this, you know, the same.
Yeah,
tones.
You don't see any swan dresses anymore.
No, no.
I thought Taraji P. Henson was incredible.
Yes.
Hair, jewelry, makeup, dress. Mm-hmm. The dress was blue, not black.
Yes.
I have confirmed it. I also love Nicole Kidman. I think she was
I say kudos to Ryan Gosling and the ruffled shirt.
Yes! Bring him back. The 70s ruffle, right?
I love that ruffled shirt. I'm curious who did the ruffled shirt. I thought that was... I thought that was really great.
I agree. It was fantastic.
But and the In Memoriam, my final thought, In the Memoriam, always tough, the people that they didn't
exclude.
Mm-hmm. And I thought they missed a real opportunity in not having Alexis Arquette.
And
that kind of bothered me because he was a wonderful actor he was in The Wedding Singer and part of the LGBT community. And I don't know. I thought that was a miss. And I believe they didn't have Alan Rickman. So there are people that they have and don't have. And then, but between them.
And have to be selective, yeah.
And TCM, yeah. But I mean, I think I don't think they had David Bowie.
Right.
But I don't know. And again, I don't know if that crosses through with the year. Or
exactly.
They
that's
I have
one
no
of the
idea
questions.
How they make their...
Exactly, when their year is.
But in TCM, they have all those people.
Sarah Bareilles singing with the In Memoriam, I thought was
so
incredible.
So you missed and then they had the one, I mean, that was class. And then they had the woman that was actually alive.
Yes!
That to me is, like, again, two, so who are we going to blame? So no one got any blame for that.
No.
That's almost worse. It's like, hey, Mom.
For the alive woman, it is.
Remember the year, Mom, that they put you up and you were dead? Like, how horrifying is that? You're home and you're like, I'm not dead. I'm not dead.
Am I dead? Hang on a minute. Let's bring in Dana.
Let's bring in Dana. I'm so excited. You know him, of course, from his stand-up comedy. He's been a writer, producer on The Simpsons, consulting producer on Parks and Rec. He wrote and created the television series Stand Against Evil, which he also appears in. He's been on so many, best comedian lists, I would have to say. And known as a comedian, ladies and gentlemen, bring on Mr. Dana Gould. And plus, I'm just so excited here because this may be the longest. We always talk. We've known each other for a long time.
Yeah,
I don't know
yeah.
if you're. You might hear better if you bring these on. I don't want to mess up your hair.
This is a toupee. Just this part.
Just that right in the front.
It's the Clark Kent forelock toupee.
That's fantastic.
But we've known each other for many years, and we're always sort of running into each other backstage.
Yes, usually at Largo or something.
And we talk about movies, and
not a lot of people. That you can talk about Gloria Graham's lip to.
Yes, that's what you mean, that you put in the cotton?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, that's I know who I'm talking to.
Do you know the Sonny Tufts story?
No.
What?
Oh, I know. Now we're like two old women. Okay. We need a pack of Merits and a coffee cake.
We got our king cake outside for Mardi Gras. Very briefly, Sonny Tufts. I love showbiz stories.
Sure.
I love Sonny. And Sonny Tufts was a B-movie actor. He usually played, like, lovable thugs. And Joseph Cotten was announcing. He was going to be on one of these Lux radio hours. And Joseph Cotten is reading the copy for the next week. And he's like, next week, the show, this person, and Sonny Tufts. And he said it, and as he said Sonny Tufts, he looked at his name and it made him laugh, and he said, Sonny Tufts. And bizarrely, overnight, it ruined Sonny Tufts' career. I kid you not. Because it became a punchline. So if a comedian, if a joke would die, the comedian would go, Sonny Tufts.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And everybody would start to laugh. And then Sonny Tufts started to go on talk shows. And they were like, ladies and gentlemen.
Sonny Tufts.
Sonny Tufts. And everyone laughing. And he'd say, I know it's funny, but it's really hurting my career. He started to get He became an alcoholic.
It's just gets worse.
Yeah, he gets arrested for biting a showgirl's leg. It's...
Oh, who hasn't been arrested for that?
But that's such a classy 40s masher move. Down on all fours.
Masher. So we were saying Gloria Graham and inside showbiz stories and things like that. But but yes, we always talk about that, of course. Planet of the Apes, and when Mickey Rooney died, because the very racist performance, Mars, this great film, Breakfast at Tiffany's.
People always go on and on and on about an amazing breakfast at Tiffany's is. It's such a classic. And then you watch it in the middle. It's like the cook in McHale's Navy was portrayed with so much more nuance and respect. There are racist Warner Brothers cartoons that are more sensitive to African Americans.
Yes.
And then Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Move up, go rivalry. And I believe I told you this. One of my managers early in my career, lovely gentleman.
Yes.
Earlier in his career, he was a stage manager on Sugar Babies.
Ah.
And
with Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller.
Yep. And he said that Mickey would always be clipping his toenails like 30 seconds. And just to drive everybody crazy. And he described Mickey Rooney's toenails as Jurassic, which I thought was wonderful.
I can't even. I got to meet Mickey Rooney. He was at the opening of, the director of Mary Poppins, who did Bed Knobs and Broomsticks.
Yes.
And they had, when they did the Disney film that Tom Hanks was in, they had a premiere for it. And okay.
Yeah, well, he played Walt Disney.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they, and Mickey, and I couldn't believe it. I was with a friend, and I said, there's Mickey Rooney. I said, I've got an in. He did a movie with my grandfather, Crabbin's Courageous. And I came over, I thought it was going to be a train wreck. And do you know that he was like, have a seat? And he sat down, he talked about Captain's Courageous. So it was a win.
I do a three-word Mickey Rooney impression.
When is it?
I can't do him, but I can do him voicing Santa Claus in Santa Claus is Coming to Town. I can do him as young Kris Kringle. Toys! Beautiful toys! That's all I can do.
I get it. That one. Did you ever see him do the Frankenheimer, the comedians? The live version?
Oh, the Rod Serling role, of course. Yeah.
Oh God!
I want to be big. That was the Twilight Zone where he was the jockey.
Yeah.
I want to be big.
It was a good John Frankenheimer said he was the best actor he ever worked with.
Probably.
Surprising.
Well, David, my manager, said, "Can you use blue language here?"
Yes, you can.
We're in the movies. We can do it.
This story involves, I'm quoting Mickey Rooney, who used the F-bomb.
Yes.
And he goes, David, come on in and I'll tell you about how I fucked my way across China with Red Grange on a War Bonds tour. I think they
I know. Everything today is very staid. But the reason I got into show business was to hear great stories like that. To work with the stars that say these crazy.
Oh, they're great.
Things were much racier before.
Oh, yeah. Well, you read back. Like, there's nothing. Well, that's the thing that you learn in life. And there's nothing new.
Yes.
Everybody's one of my favorite stories involving Natalie Wood of the two, and one of them's terrible. But
I already know the other one.
Yeah, you do know the champagne tub where they go. Natalie Wood and Dennis Hopper and some other people were sort of methodically planning out an orgy, which I didn't know that you did. You know, you need Lionel Atwill to come down and really set the rules down.
Yes.
Famed orgy master Lionel Atwill, which is a military level that's gone to the dogs. Back when I was a kid, orgy master meant something. But they were literally like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And then they filled a bathtub with champagne, and they all got in it, and Natalie Wood's exposed body parts hit the champagne, which is a alcohol-based.
Yes.
It burned.
Yes. Sure.
That was the end of their
evening.
And you don't think of that. I've certainly never been in that situation.
Well, going back to Gloria Graham, I believe...
We were going to have a benefit car wash or an orgy, and we ended up having
We ended up with that. No, when you read these, I pieced together all the, who slept with who, and who... Sometimes it's shocking.
Yes.
You know, my grandfather, Melvin Douglas, I was talking to a producer, and he said, well, your grandfather had an affair with Greta Garbo, and I said, I don't think so. And he goes, oh, come on. They did three pictures together. So I was kind of like,
oh, yeah.
I guess it's, you know, like in those days, yeah. I think it was.
Doesn't speak well for June Lockhart and Lassie, but we'll just let it go. Yeah.
It was a kind of coda. Okay. The all right. You know, here we go. I know. Just doing showbiz stories. My favorite question, when she started off, what was the first film you saw and who took you to it? And how did it scar you?
The first movie I went to see
yes.
was, as you mentioned, Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Yes.
And I was, it was probably 68 or 69 when I saw it. I was 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing the commercials, and it was a knight lifted up his faceplate, and there was nothing in it. And I was into horror movies that early. I was I want to see that. And I believe I went with my cousin Bonnie. Mm-hmm. And it was fine. It wasn't the movie that rocked me, but it was I loved the whole thing. I later worked in the movie theater that I saw it in.
See, we haven't had a guest on where there hasn't, because I always believe there's some bizarre thing, wet cement in the brain, and the mm-hmm. something about the early movie, and it sets some tone.
Yep.
Of some future, you know, knowledge or experience. Or
well, yeah. I mean, not to get too airy fairy. I grew up in a bleak little mill town in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. and it was about as far from
Hopedale. Where is Hopedale?
Where is that? What listed in the ironically named towns of America. it's about 50 minutes southwest of Boston, and uh-huh. it's just a little mill town. It's a home to me and Joe Perry from Aerosmith.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know that. I know that area, though. The mill town, Lowell, Massachusetts.
All in the, they're all the same town, out yes. by the where the marathon starts.
Yes.
And you know, there was I was right away. I was not into it. You know, right?
Put me here?
Yeah, I know. You know, it's like, well, this is where you go to high school and you become an alcoholic and you work at the foundry and then you
die.
It's
so funny. I very much relate to that.
Yeah,
because I had an existence too, like where I knew that I had did not. I knew I was like, I should be living in New York. I don't know why. Well,
but you grew up.
I grew up in, I was born in Massachusetts, and then grew up in Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
Same thing, very rural.
So even though you had show business in your family, you didn't grow up here?
No. My grandfather lived in Upper West Side, New York, and then all my relatives lived in Queens.
Right, okay.
And so most of my I had movie experiences in the rural were at the drive-in.
Right.
And that kind of.
You stole my heart.
Yeah, or the 99-cent theater where it had already played for a year.
Yeah.
You know, like, you saw Young Frankenstein, it was like the last of the last
You know. That's really funny.
Yeah, for 99 cents, you mm-hmm. know.
On a double bill with...
Definitely on a
double bill. With Mother, Jugs, and Speed.
Always on a double bill.
Or Greased Lightning.
And I went to the... Did you go to the drive-in a lot?
See, not only did I go to the drive-in, the drive-in was a... That's what etched... on to me. And
me too.
I later worked at this drive-in, and I still go to the drive-in. And one of my, there's a wonderful drive-in 50 minutes east of Los Angeles mm-hmm. called Mission Tiki. Mm-hmm. And it's an old drive-in that we used to go to, ironically, in the 90s.
Right.
Me and my friends, when it was like you could get knifed. And since then, it's in Montclair, easily remembered because it's next to Claremont.
Oh.
And it's out in the Inland Empire, as I like to call it, God's country. And and they have 4 screens, and it's completely renovated, and they have a beautiful snack bar, and it's all tiki themed, and it's like going back in time. It's it's a time machine, and that's my favorite thing. And my kids, we go in the summer. We go, you know, at least 2 or 3 times a month. We go to the drive-in.
Wow!
And I love it now that my oldest daughter, is like, hey, let's go to the drive-in, which is great. And we just go, and I just adore it. There's something about it. The smell of popcorn, the whole, it's just great.
It's such a nostalgic.
Yeah, it's your best memories of your childhood. In my case, the best memories of my childhood at the drive-in. The first movie that really, like, was Escape from the Planet of the Apes, mm-hmm. which played at our drive-in, and which I... made my parents take me to, which was no small task.
Right.
I was 6 or 7, early summer of 1971. Mm-hmm. So I was 6. And I had four older brothers and a younger sister that was a baby at that point. And my parents are not into doing what we wanted to do, you know.
I love parents were so different.
Yeah,
then.
It was Mad Men. It was Mad Men. It was just like out of sight, out of mind.
Yes.
And there's a thing in the first or second episode of Mad Men where they're having a party at the house and a kid runs through the house and a guy that's just in the house slaps the kid in the face and tells him to slow down.
Yeah.
And it's utterly acceptable. I was like, yeah, that's where I grew up.
Yes. I remember that.
And and I made them and we went to the drive-in and I saw Escape from the Planet of the Apes. And the second, I remember the second feature, which we did not stay for, which probably wouldn't have worked for me at the time as I was six, Bobby Deerfield.
Oh,
the Al Pacino car racing movie. But I remember it. I was six, and I still remember it. And then later in high school, the drive-in was owned by the local theater, and I worked at both. You'd look at the board, and like some days you were at the two-screen theater, some days you were downtown at the three-screen theater, or you were at the drive-in and you jumped around. It was all the same company.
Right.
And that's where I saw, like, summer of 81 and 82, I saw all those Blade Runner, Wrath of Khan, all those movies I saw.
What was the movie that you saw? For me, it was Network. I saw the movie Network was a movie that was more, like I said, it's something more, you could actually make something artistic. Was there a movie like that?
The original Planet of the Apes, that whole thing.
It's a great film.
The original was a fantastic movie, and I enjoyed all of them in their various levels of quality. But it utterly transfixed me and galvanized me when I saw them advertised on television.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with those films and the way kids get obsessed about baseball. And I didn't carry around a baseball glove. I carried around Marvel's Planet of the Apes magazine. And then I really get into horror movies. And the reason that I wanted to be an actor, was I wanted to act in horror movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you want to be in like a Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, I wanted to be.
You wanted to be the ape, or you wanted to be Charlton Heston?
Well, I wanted to be Charlton Heston. I didn't have the figure for it, but and I later met. I can tell you the story about meeting Charlton Heston, which was fascinating. But
yeah,
I wanted to be Peter Cushing. I wanted to be.
Oh, right.
Like, I wanted to be the guy that killed Dracula, and I finally have achieved it. I had to. True to my career, I had to create the show. Like, I had to become a writer, sell a show, get the show on the air, give myself a tiny, tiny, tiny part.
Yes.
You know. I've been a Planet of the Apes fan all my life for everything except the Tim Burton movie.
Oh, right. I know. Well, it's too real. I don't know. And the other one had such great actors, Roddy McDowell. Yeah. Did you get to meet Roddy McDowell? You later?
Just
crazy. You have to.
I have a very weird story. I have three main crazy stories. Moving chronologically.
Your life defined by one film.
Yeah. You could say that. I think you could
it
say
is.
That. Yeah. That speaks really poorly of me.
No, I'm not saying
called
you're
consistency.
What did he do in life? He saw this movie a lot. Anything else? Nothing to speak.
You know
of.
Why this is called I Blame Dennis Hopper? Because my father saw Easy Rider and emulated Dennis Hopper. Became Dennis Hopper. So to me, that is the power of one film can really.
Also, what Natalie Wood screamed when she jumped out of the tub.
Yep.
I think a lot of people.
A lot of people blame Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
In the late 90s, I had kind of achieved a level of notoriety as a comedian, and I was on a sitcom, and I was doing well. I was making a living. And I was on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, which was the show that preceded Real Time.
Yes.
And I was on with Charlton Heston.
Oh, my God.
Which is crazy.
It's crazy.
And when they told me that, I was like, you know what this means to me, right? And they're like, what? And I was the only one that knew. Like, nobody at my manager or my agency, like, cared. And so I go there, and he came out separately. Like, we're all seated, and he came out separately. And I sat closer to him than I am to you now.
Yes.
And he's an incredibly imposing figure.
Yeah.
He's literally larger than life. And we had a back and forth about guns or something, and I had recently been held up. And I said something about, like, well, I didn't believe in guns or school prayer. And then I had a gun in my face, and I believed in both really quick. And they cut to the commercial. But he was making a point, and I interrupted him. And then it got a big laugh, and then they went to commercial.
Oh.
And he didn't get to make his point.
Uh-oh.
And it was just one of those things, like, I didn't even, it's just like the joke comes out of the mail slot, and jump at it. Comedians are otters. You know, we just jump. And then he leaned forward.
Oh my God!
And grab my arm, and I was just like, no. And I'm envisioning, if you ever do that again, like I'm really, it's like, this is gonna ruin a lot for me.
Yeah.
And he grabbed my arm and he went, so you're an actor, you're doing well. Clearly you're on the show. Things are going well. And we had this lovely chat.
Oh my God.
Come back from commercial. This ding dong doesn't know what he's talking about. And then, you know, we finish the thing, and then commercial again, and just like, you know, if you have a tough year, the Cobra plan on your insurance. I started that. It's like he could not have been more solicitous, more kind-hearted.
Yeah.
And then after the show, he was there with Lydia, his wife.
Yes.
And I said, I had a Christmas card that I had made with my face over an ape holding a mortgage. And I said, I'll never forget this. I said, Mr. Heston, this is a little dorky, but this is my Christmas card. If you could sign it for me, it'd be great. And he's saying, Lydia, look what he crafted with scissors and a paste pot. Like, yeah, these antiquated phrases, you know, ingenuity. But just like old school, like just so great.
Yes.
And signed it, and then he started to walk away. I have a witness to this. He started to walk away. If anyone knows Rob Cohen, he's Jill Lederman, who produces Jimmy Kimmel Live. Rob
yes.
Cohen's Jill's husband. Rob was standing next to me when this happened. He started to walk away. He stopped, turned around, walked back, and clasped me by the shoulders. And he went, this might be dorky too, but I'd be happy to send you a picture from the film if you'd like. And I went, that would be amazing. He's like, give me your address. Fill it. Like 4 days later, 8.5 by 11 envelope in the mail.
Wow.
And I can't read what he wrote. It really looks like he wrote, to Dana, happy couch, Charlton Heston. I don't know what it is. It's an idiom. It's an old Yiddish idiom. But he
That's
was...
That's incredible.
Yeah, but he was incredibly kind-hearted and lovely. And that really influenced me, like when I'm in my piddly little fame, when I meet people that like me, I'm always because this moment's about them. It's, you know, that moment was, he knew that was about me. It wasn't about him meeting him, and that's really important. So that was that, and then, you know, you get into this out here in LA. There's this sort of fandom world, and people know, and through friends of friends of friends, I have my friend Brian, who was really good friends with Roddy McDowall, who's the biggest Planet of the Apes fan going, bigger than me, owns the Lawgiver statue from the 9-foot statue that he bought at the Sammy Davis Jr. estate sale. And it was given to Sammy Davis Jr. by Arthur P. Jacobs, who produced the movie. And he has it in his house, and he was friends with Roddy. And he said... we're having a salon for Roddy. This is 98. You should come. So I go, and Roddy was not like Charlton Heston. He was probably a little overwhelmed, you know, you knew him well.
Yes.
And
right at this time, actually.
Uh-huh.
Around 98. Yes.
Ex Moppet. Yes. Was his license plate.
Yes.
Yeah. He had a red Mercedes.
Yeah. And the members only jet with the cuffs. Like, he...
Yeah. Yeah. He was a...
Like, the cuffs were...
Yeah.
Yeah. Just old. So old school.
Yeah. White pants. White pants, white shoes. Yeah. That's what he's wearing in this photo. So, long story, painfully longer. I meet him, and I'm kind of snarky. And I say, you know what? This is so perfectly... I go, you know what movie of yours I love? The Cool Ones, which is this terrible, like, late 60s.
Yeah.
If you can't beat them, join them. And he basically plays Phil Spector.
Right.
Pre-murder Phil Spector.
Uh-huh.
And he went like this. It was so funny because he did something and then he caught himself and he went,
when I said the cool ones. And then he likes it. He goes, actually, that's a very good film. And I still write the director. We send postcards. And so.
Uncle Roddy.
Yeah. Couldn't be nicer. Got a photo of him with me standing with him in front of the lawgiver statue. Later. And then to show you like how far removed my life is from my family of origin, I sent that picture to my parents. Like, look!
Aww.
You know, I used to harass you to take me to the drive-in to see these movies. And now I know the guy.
Yeah.
And my dad's response was, saw that picture of you and your queer friend.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
You know, it's just like... and then Roddy passed away in 1999, I believe, or December 98, I believe. Or
I think it was 99.
Yeah,
I think it was 99.
Late 90s. He died, he lived across the street from Gene Autry, and they both died on the same day. Mm-hmm. How do I know this? Because I bought his house.
Yes.
When Roddy died, the estate sold it to a guy who flipped it. My wife and I, at the time, we didn't have children yet. But we knew we were going to have children. We were looking at the house. It fit all the criteria. It was a little out of our price range.
Mm-hmm.
But we were both working. You know, I was on the Simpsons. And, you know, we were at the height of our power.
Mm-hmm.
And the owner goes, well, it used to belong to an actor. It used to belong to this actor named Roddy McDowell. and I was standing here, and I can see my wife. I can feel her eyes like boring into me because it's also her father's favorite film, so it's like very, and she was like, well, that's it, there's no way, there's
you had
no
to
way.
Yeah, but they didn't have that, but he didn't, because at Roddy's house he had the statue
of Caesar from Battle for the Planet of the Apes that was refurbished for him by my friend Brian,
yes,
who owns the Lawgiver statue, and that statue now sits in the Rose Garden at the Screen Actors Guild Retirement Home.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's right. Yes.
And I did get a statue, the tendrils of my fandom of this movie. So Brian had a mold made at Fox's request of the 9-foot Lawgiver statue.
Right.
And a guy named, a special effects guy made the mold, and they started to struck a mold because they wanted one for a Fox studio in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And then this guy liquidated his stock, it was whatever. It was. And me and two other gentlemen who will remain nameless bought the mold. So, like, I'm now part owner of a Lawgiver mold. And I had a bust of it by the pool in the house.
Yes.
Which was sort of like my nod to Roddy. Now, and we have a little room in the bathroom. The famous bathroom in the house was also a little shrine to Roddy.
Yeah, that play, it was unbelievable. He used to have these dinner parties.
Well,
why is the bathroom famous?
Well, he had, I think Robert Downey Jr. passed out in it once. Pre-Iron Man. But he had all of these amazing photos of, like, just Kodak photos of, like, Harrison Ford and Betty Davis in my kitchen.
Yeah.
A letter from Fox in a frame, apologizing to him because they inadvertently submitted him for the Best Actor Award for Cleopatra, not Best Supporting Actor, which they were convinced that he would have won. And all of these amazing things. This stuff, you can all see it, because when he passed away, Paul Rubens said to the caretaker, like, you have to save the bathroom. And they literally took it in, took a bunch of photographs, took everything out of it, and reconstructed it in the Max Factor Hollywood History Museum.
Yes.
When we bought the house, we wanted to restore it because it had a kind of a what I call an IKEA flip. So we wanted to restore it. So we went down there and photographed it, and I saw all the stuff. And then in what we did to it was we just have a lot of pictures of Roddy and the photo of me and Roddy and a letter that I bought at an auction that Roddy wrote to a fan in like the 40s and stuff like that. It's just like our little sop to Roddy. Roddy also had these things called, and even Roddy, he was a big beneficiary of the Screen Actors Guild home, and he used to have these famous dinners at his house.
Yes.
And so we continued that.
Oh, got an invite.
Well, we only did one, and then I moved out of the house.
Oh, no.
And then I moved out of the
house.
No, it's not a bad story. Okay. I'll tell you the whole thing.
Uh-oh.
And so we had this an evening at Roddy's. And then I was at a an event at the Screen Actors Guild home, and I met his sister. And I said to her, "As my name is Dana Gould, I live in the house on Brookdale, and we've restored it. And I just wanted to let you know that it's always open to you if you ever, for whatever reason, want to come and see the rose bushes or whatever. It's always open to you." And she just went, "I think that would be weird."
And you're like, "I love it.
Go fuck myself." Yeah, you know what? You know, I think I will go fuck myself. Thank you. I'm going to fuck myself right now. Well, when my wife and I got divorced, not horribly, we have a great relationship. We both hate me. We have a lot in common. No, that's not true. That's not true. I said to my daughter, I said, "Well, do you want me to take this statue?" The Lawgiver statue was by the pool. And my daughter went, I go, "Do you want me to leave that here?" And she went, "No! No!" Because she's a girl.
Yeah.
So I took it to my new house, which is right up the street.
It's like The Jerk. You're
what? Yes! It was a giant lawyer. But it was just too big for my new yard. It's my... And I'm like... I'm looking at this thing going like, I have to get laid again at some point in my life. So I gave it to my friend Dean, who is a writer on Real Time with Bill Maher and is as big a Planet of the Apes fan as any. So much so... Mm-hmm. That his wife auditioned for and got in the new Planet of the Apes movies. Mm-hmm. She's Cornelia, Andy Serkis's wife, in the new Planet of the Apes movies.
Oh, my God.
Every time she sees me, she says, "You ruined my yard."
You're welcome. You
have, great.
With tongue-in-cheek. She's lovely and a great actress.
Okay, I know my only last thing is that it was very funny because you later went on Turner Classic Movies with our friend Ben Mankiewicz.
Yes.
And I've seen this as incarnation.
And you can see it again
I've seen
next
this
month.
Incarnation. And do you know that I have...
Were you at the Wayne Fetterman show when I did it?
Yeah.
With Paul Williams?
With Paul Williams. I actually have video of it from backstage.
Oh, I would love to see that video. Yeah, I don't.
It's very funny.
One of my side careers is I've become the world's leading Dr. Zaius impersonator. And I'm doing it April 8th at the Roosevelt Hotel for the Turner Classic Film Festival.
What?
We're going to introduce the apes.
Do people know that? Because I'm... Have you... Because I...
Maybe I blew it, but I know that's happening.
Oh, that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. Because I know you're going to.
I play him like an old. I play him like an old. Well, you saw it, like an old celebrity, like an old celebrity you'd see on Merv, just like name dropping. Is you know, I live out in Santa Barbara now. Yes. Susie Flechette made me move out there. You couldn't get me out of Brentwood, and she goes, "You got to come to Santa Barbara." And now I have horses. I have an Etsy store. I stay very busy. You can't get me out of the place. But let me a word of advice. I'll tell you right now, and you'll take it or leave it. Never buy a house from Jim Gregory unless you want to stay in escrow the rest of your life, because he's impossible.
Oh, God. No, you
would know Mrs. Miller.
You have to do, before you do it, did you ever see the Maureen O'Hara interview that Robert Osborne did? No. Okay, Maureen O'Hara, you know, bless her heart, older and having some memory problems. And no matter what Robert Osborne asked her, she'd go, "Charles Laughton brought me over from Ireland," you know, and he'd go, "Yes, that's lovely. And what are some of the other people?" You know, "Charles Laughton."
Oh, man.
And it was like around, and everyone else was frozen. But of course, I love stuff like that.
And that's great. It's when an entire group of people just agree to not hurt someone's feelings.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the country's doing now with the president. Just let him go. Just let him go.
I ignore it. That's why I think that was my theory. Was like, the Oscars we can get a handle on.
Well, somebody always says, like, don't pay attention to what he says. And that's like taking somebody to see a giraffe. Just don't look at its neck. It's all neck. How can you say that? It's all neck. It's the only reason it exists.
I can't. It's like a bad movie come to life. Okay, now other obsessions.
Yes.
We share, but you obviously know him. I met him once and just stared at him.
Yeah.
While he talked for 45 minutes, is with Albert Brooks.
Yes.
The great
Mr.
Albert Brooks.
And before seeing how you met him, growing up, like, how did you come through records, through movies?
Yeah, I mean, I was aware of him. Mm-hmm. And then around high school, you know, I knew who he was. I remember mm-hmm. it was on The Odd Couple. He played an ad man on The Odd Couple. Oscar, you are Mandar. He played like the hip groovy commercial director on An Odd Couple.
Yeah. I discovered him through Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, Saturday Night Live, I remember him on. And then, but when I got older and I was a comedian, this is like the late 80s, early 90s, I was a comedian, I was mm-hmm. working, and I really got into like a deep dish comedy. Like I really started to like indulge my mm-hmm. interests in the way that musicians, like a kid who wants to be a guitarist will start, you know, he'll copy Keith Richards. Mm-hmm. And then if he's worth his salt and really loves it, then that will lead him to Bo Diddley or Howling mm-hmm. Wolf. And he'll track down his influences, and he'll go to his influences, and mm-hmm. and he'll go down further. And comedians do the same thing mm-hmm. if they're passionate about it. And then I started to really, and then I get into all of Albert Brooks's stuff, and then you go down to all of Harry Shearer's stuff and Albert's interests, and then Modern Romance was also like 2 years of my life. So when I saw Modern Romance, it was really like, I did this.
Yeah. And that was sort of more of a cult movie. I mean, now it's become popular, but of all of his movies, that's the movie that came out that not too many people knew about.
Right.
But we'd meet someone, and it was always, for me, a bonding thing.
Well, when I became friends with, when I met Ben Stiller before the Ben Stiller show, this was like 89. I went to New York. I was visiting with my friend Janine Garofalo, mm-hmm. and she goes, "You got to meet my friend Ben." And then I didn't know him. He was just Ben. I knew who his parents were, because I was a comedy nerd.
Yeah.
And then we were both just talking. And the thing that everybody had in common was we all wanted to be Albert Brooks. Like we could all just, if I call Janine Garofalo right now, I haven't spoken to her in about 7 months. Mm-hmm. At the end of the call, she'll go, "Turkey dinner now, turkey dinner." And that's from A Star Is Born.
Yeah.
That's from, you know, or Comedy Minus One. It's from one of those other,
yes.
One of those. And we know every word of that album, you know, and that will be our,
Richie Havens. You
know, yeah. Reference. Don't feed. There was a last man before the stage. Sign said that over his head. Last man before stage. Don't feed. And then oddly through Janine, I met Albert Brooks later, and then I met him at the Aspen Comedy Festival. And to me, it's always like chatting with if the Beach Boys were Chuck Berry's music. If the mm-hmm. Beach Boys were Chuck Berry playing behind the Four Freshmen, mm-hmm. which is Brian Wilson's math for the Beach Boys.
Right.
It's like I take four freshman harmonies and I put them on a Chuck Berry song. Mm-hmm. And that's the Beach Boys. My stand-up is George Carlin's material delivered by Albert Brooks. Mm-hmm. It's the intensity of Albert Brooks, but it's my but all the algorithms of my writing are George Carlin's algorithms. Mm-hmm. And so he's a huge, influence. And it's when I talk to him, we're not friends, we're friendly, mm-hmm. because I was on The Simpsons for a long time and he was there and we'd be at parties together. And it's like chatting with the Statue of Liberty. I can't get over, there are two people in my career that called out my name in public, and I got like freakishly chills by it. One was at a party, and I was kind of looking at Simpsons party, and I'm kind of peeking at him out of the corner of my eye, and finally he went, "Hello, Dana." And I was just like, "Oh, I didn't know you remembered me." And once I was leaving a show at the Groundlings with my then wife, and Paul Rubens went, "Good night, Sue. Good night, Dana." And it was like, oh my God, Paul Rubens just called her. So that's crazy. It was just one of those things. You're like, that just happened. That's really weird.
Now, did you ever talk to Albert about any of his films or the writing? Because films aren't the most cinematic, but they're obviously the scripts are so brilliant.
Yeah, they're so brilliant. We talked once. I had a really interesting story. We talked about Stanley Kubrick a lot because mm-hmm. he loved Stanley Kubrick, and he was friends. Apparently, they were like phone buddies for a while. And I can only tell the story in my I'll tell the story, but I'm doing my impression of Kevin Pollak's impression of Albert Brooks.
Right. Okay.
You know, it goes. You have to trace it down. And it was Stanley and I were friends, and I called him on the phone because I was, you know, he's an insomniac. I'm up during the day. It's 4 a.m. in London. He's up. We chat on the phone. And I'm watching Johnny, and Scatman Crothers is on. He's promoting Bronco Billy. And he sits down with Johnny and goes, "How was it working with Clint Eastwood?" And Johnny goes, "Johnny, I did one take, and Clint Eastwood said, 'Cut, print it, let's move on.' And I started crying, Johnny. I started crying." And Johnny goes, "Well, that's crazy. Why'd you do that?" And Scatman goes, "Stanley Kubrick made me get out of a snow cat 87 times. And I go, this is amazing. So I call up Stanley and I go, "Stanley, it's Albert. Scatman Crothers is dragging your name through the mud on The Tonight Show." And Stanley erupts from across the ocean, "Don't ever work with Scatman Crothers." But I was trying to be smart. I was going like, "Well, you'll do stuff
Yeah.
I was going like, you know, the scene in Modern Romance when you're on Quaaludes and you're playing the records, that's all one take. Mm. You never cut.
Right.
And I go, that's like when Poole and the other astronaut are in the pod in 2001 talking. And he goes, no, that's Hal not blinking. Humans blink. Hal can't blink." And I was just like, "Of course, well, you're a lot smarter than I am."
And I'm sure he, did you see, you know, rapid fire without even.
Oh, he's free. Yeah, he's a phenom. And it's crazy that I got to meet him. It's crazy that I got to meet him.
And
I got to meet George Carlin. I got to meet and kind of know both of my big comedic influences, which is not something I take for granted.
Well, I can see the Albert Brooks reference because he does the uncomfortable sort of comedy, which I love, which is very human. You know, you find yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
At odds with, you know. Is there something, like, when you're in life, you know, obviously every day you go through life and you say every incident, you say, this is funny or this is not funny or.
Well, to me now, it's, it just kind of comes. I've been doing, I'm 52 and I started doing stand-up professionally when I was 17. So, like, it's kind of second nature now.
Right.
And I'll know, and I'm weird about things like, I'm very careful about what I talk about. Like, I don't talk about my divorce or anything in any way other than myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are people in your life that, you know, didn't ask to be.
Right.
You know, and in all honesty, my in that particular situation, it's not very rewarding comedically. It was, it was pretty adult. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, like, to me, whatever triggers you will trigger something. I was literally, this is my new favorite bit, where I was literally listening to the news, and there was a story about a woman in North Carolina, and it was during the hurricane, and her house was filling up with water, but she couldn't go outside because the water outside of her house was filled with snakes and alligators. And I'm not here to judge anybody. But if you're going to drown in your own home because the water outside is filled with snakes and alligators, you did something. Life is not that cruel. You know, like, I'm sure even the National Guard is like, "Go out, we'll lower a ladder." "I can't. The water is filled with snakes and alligators." "Jesus Christ, lady, what the hell did you do?" And then it spins on and on. And that's very much an Albert Brooks routine. Like, the intensity and the rhythms are all Albert Brooks's.
And how do you
He might not think that, but in my mind it is.
Right.
No, well, in my mind it's all the Richie Havens story.
Yes.
The way he tells that story.
Yeah, when I was acting, when I first started acting, I just did Richard Dreyfuss, which I wrote about, you know, like that was my thing.
Yeah.
And there was a progression because I loved Groucho Marx.
Uh-huh.
And you know, but I sort of grew out of it, the Marx Brothers, and then I discovered Richard Dreyfuss in The Goodbye Girl.
Right.
And that became my comic timing.
Right.
That I
absolutely. Absolutely.
That I did until I had to work with him.
You know, like, them's my rules, sister.
Yeah, I couldn't stop. I was supposed to be doing a serious scene, and it was like I was so miscast because all I wanted to do was laugh because he had the time.
Right. You know, but did you? And you also think, I see why Robert Shaw hated you.
I get along with the challenging ones because I understand. I do not judge. And again, comes from having a crazy upbringing.
Yeah,
you have to remain calm at all times. You know, and so that's. I always think that I just like know how to be like. I wait till the tirade is over, and then I just go, okay, great. You know, like, sure, ready to go. Tell me, you know, and I know how to not just non-response to drama.
Also, in my instance, growing up in a family full of people that were often drunk.
How does your family feel? Because
they don't know.
Oh, they don't even watch.
They're not even aware
successful you are.
Not really.
That's sad. That makes me sad. But
when I'm on Fox News, they'll suddenly be very aware of me.
But is that the root of then the comedy becomes the root of the certain unfairness, like the woman with the snakes, in a sense?
Yeah.
Arbitrary, like you said, you were placed in the wrong home. You should have been.
Yeah. And you know, to get very like psychological about it, like, you know, I was a small kid with four huge older brothers. Mm-hmm. And when we got into adolescence, they were in their teen years. Mm-hmm. And they were drunk and they were, you know, bullying assholes. Mm-hmm. And I hate bullies.
Right.
And so this particular presidency really triggers a lot of stuff in me.
Yes.
And, you know, and unfortunately I have my show to, mm-hmm. my comedy to vent about it, but it does. And stand up was absolutely a way to mm-hmm. survive. I mean, it's you don't need
Freud to solve that puzzle.
Did you always have such a facility with words? You know, like again, just pulling a word like paste pot. Like I'm still thinking about that.
Yeah, I wrote it down.
I'm still, you know, because like
I think he said it.
But that's what. That's what
I have a good memory, and I read. Well, I didn't play sport. You know, I didn't play sport. Everybody, all the guys in my family, like they were athletes. My dad was scouted by the Cleveland Indians mm-hmm. as a pitcher. Mm-hmm. Ended up the Korean War interrupted. My brother was an all-state baseball player. And then they hunt and they fish. And that's their life.
The idea of you out there
I'll show you a picture of my dad and my brother, and you will not believe that they're my dad and my brother.
You weren't switched at the hospital?
No, I look exactly like my father.
Oh, no.
Which is really weird.
Oh, he must really hate you.
No, we have a great relationship now. We have a great relationship now. You know, because I did not play sports and I did not hunt and I did not fish, they thought I was gay. Like they couldn't conceive that a heterosexual would not do that stuff.
Yeah,
and really, like it took a long time. At one point I was like, I'm gay if that's what bothers you the most.
Yeah,
you know, whatever bugs you about, but. I could never stay in that good a shape. What my dad understands is the only thing preventing me from being gay is my love of bread. You know? Stand-up was the tool that I used to sort of comment on that. And I just read all the time as a kid. I was mm-hmm. reading Planet of the Apes magazine and Famous Monsters magazine mm-hmm. when I was a kid. And that led me to reading, you know, like Robert Louis Stevenson and Bram Stoker. And I was reading all these monster movies and monster books.
Right.
And constantly reading as a kid. And all that stuff just stuck.
It's interesting we say that about Albert Brooks because I did the same thing. So if I'm reading about Groucho Marx... And then Groucho Marx mentions, I like Goodman Ace. I'm like, I don't know who Goodman Ace is, but let me look it up. So that's becomes,
you know, or you go, like, I read Dorothy Parker, and then, okay, I'm done with Dorothy Parker, and then that leads me to someone else.
To Robert Benchley, and then exactly. to Peter Benchley, and then to Richard Dreyfuss.
Yes.
There you
go. Connected it.
I don't think Robert Benchley and Peter Benchley were related.
They might be. You never know. Okay, so two things I want to talk about, because I was very, when we were working together on the show Fired, I loved the story that you told, and I sort of ended up doing, because I thought, that's so weird. I'm going to steal that idea. Even though it said that springboarding a career as an actor to becoming what you really wanted to do, which is to be, you know, writer, producer, right. director.
Well, it was the inverse. I wanted to be a movie star.
Right.
I wanted to be a famous actor.
Yeah, who doesn't? And
so, right, of course.
But a famous actor like 40s, 50s that didn't exist anymore, like me? Like, I wanted to be Eve Arden, but...
Right, yeah. I didn't even want to be a famous actor. I just wanted to be an actor that was so successful that I could be in the kind of movies that I like to go see.
Do you have an example? Like, for me, Steve Buscemi, John Turturro have the greatest...
I agree completely. Yeah, like, that's what I want, you know. Yeah. But to me, like, I would like to be so... Like, I want to be the star of Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. I'll become a successful writer. Mm-hmm. And I'll become... No. I'll be an actor.
Yeah.
And I'll become so successful that they'll let me write the movies that I want to do.
Yeah.
It's like, instead of just becoming a goddamn writer.
Right. You know, it's like, right. Well, that's because that's much harder.
Yeah, it is. It was just like, it's sort of like the theory behind is being like, I want to be a pastry chef. And if I'm elected president of the United States, they'll have to let me bake anything I want. You know, it was a very backwards approach to becoming a writer. And I realized I could just become a writer.
Is that because you are more interesting than the parts you would be cast into play? Like, is there a certain boredom level? Because acting, I mean, I loved some of the, you know, I haven't seen you in a lot of things.
Well, I'm not an actor. I'm a.
But you're very funny on camera.
I'm a writer that does some acting. You know, that's I don't have a passion to be on the. You know, I don't have a passion for, like, an actor. Will, if he's not doing a movie, he's doing a play. You
right.
know, it's like, I have a passion for acting. Mm-hmm. I'd rather blow my brains out than do a play. Uh-huh. I did a one-man show, and I was just like, we did this last night. Why am I doing it again?
I really. Yeah. Plays are hard.
Yeah, plays are hard. And I know. But I love, you know, I love creating worlds, and I love creating, so I'm pretty good at it, you know. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I picked up some skills. And then I really love doing that. So, like Stand Against Evil, my little TV show, mm-hmm. is, you know, what if, I love horror movies and I have my life, so I put them together. What if my dad had to fight monsters? What if my dad was Buffy the Vampire Slayer? Mm-hmm. Instead of an innocent teenage girl, it was an old racist guy that believed in monsters and just didn't care.
Right.
You know, and that's what the show is. It's a sitcom trapped in a horror movie. And I'm good at that, and I enjoy doing that. Mm-hmm. And then because the show is successful, I did give myself the little part that Steve Buscemi would play in the movie.
Right.
The caretaker of the cemetery, but that has this incredibly interesting life that nobody ever cares about. It's like, you know,
yes.
You know, when I lived for 4 years in a monastery on Machu Picchu. Would you excuse me 1 minute, please? Nobody ever cares.
Did you ever listen? Were you ever a Peter Sellers fan? Did you ever listen?
I was a huge
to his records and the characters.
Well, I know the Goons. I know the Goon Show and stuff. And again, the Goon Show is one of those things that I discovered because I loved Monty Python.
Right.
And Monty Python led me to and the Beatles.
Yes.
I discovered the Goons through, like, reading about the Beatles. George Martin goes to the Goon Show.
George Harrison.
Yeah.
Yes. They were all fans of that.
Yeah.
The story that you told, I don't know if you can do a truncated version of it, but the Jimmy the Idiot.
Jimmy the Idiot. I was.
I used to stand. Now again, I got to brag on you because, like, our producer Annabelle
Gurwitz.
Annabelle Gurwitz. I know too many Annabelles. I almost said Annabelle Sciorra. No, the other Annabelle, I know. But she would always get mad at me for, I was between, I had, it was like you and then Paul Feig and Paul Tompkins. And I, every night, I was just learning to be a writer. So I was like, oh, I got to change that. I got to, because I would get inspired because I would hear your funny story. I thought your story was so funny. And I would always follow you. But I'd stand in the wings. And then it gave me a lot of courage. I would have to say that. You know, doing that show because
you
were somebody that, again, I really admired. That was just the beginning of people like, oh, I don't just have to be an actor. I could actually write my own material. Yeah. And I think that for you, that was really a turning point in terms of later getting on for The Simpsons. Anyway, I interrupted you.
No.
Your great story.
Well, anyway, I was, you know, again, trying to be an actor so I could become a writer.
I know.
And you have to back it up. I was at the Aspen Comedy Festival.
Yes. Now extinct.
Now extinct. Yeah. And it's that's an executive. Where do people need stand-up comedy? Aspen. The existential agony.
You'd always see someone really famous walking around in a cast. You would.
I was in Aspen once, and these people, they're on the corner, and they have these backpacks with hoses, and they give out hot chocolate. And they give out hot, I go, how you doing? It goes, pretty good. I go, everybody doing okay? He goes, yeah, people are great. People are great. Go, met any assholes? Garrison Keillor.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's always.
Oh, that was the greatest. Again, another, when show business used to be fun.
Right.
Just a great place where people would try out material. And
it was great.
Yeah.
And so I was at Aspen, and I was hanging out with John Landis, who I had written some stuff for.
Yes, and the director.
The director who made one of my favorite movies, An American Werewolf in London. And he was there for the anniversary of Animal House, mm-hmm. and all the surviving cast was there. And my friend Lisa Lane Gang, who booked the festival, said, there's a big party at John Peters Ranch tomorrow afternoon. And everyone's going to be there, and they want to know if you want to do stand-up.
Oh.
And as I have my tongue on the top of my lip, John Landis goes, of course you'll do it! Yes, he is doing it! Oh. And then he said, you can't not do it! And so I'm like, okay. Okay, I'll do it. Okay. John Landis, what am I going to do?
Yeah, yeah. Shut up, John Landis. Yeah.
So I go there. And it's hell on earth. It's a giant, I mean, John Peter, just imagine what his place looks like. And there's a circus tent and a stage at the far end of the circus tent. And everyone in show business who was alive at that time clustered to the back of the tent.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Comedy Sides of Dana Gould.
Well, just before I go on to end my career.
Yes.
John gets the entire cast of Animal House and marches down the front of the tent and sits in the front table. And then everybody follows down. And the lawyer played by John Travolta in the O.J. miniseries.
Yes.
Whatever his name was.
Yes, I can't think of his name. Shapiro.
Shapiro. Robert Shapiro.
Robert Shapiro.
Was there.
Yeah.
Was there. And this was... God. Right after this was like 2 years after the trial. So it's like a year after the trial. 97. And I go, "There's a thank you very much, Robert Shapiro. Just one question before we start. Mr. Robert Shapiro is here. Just a quick question. No big deal. What were you thinking?" And he... Because I was literally like, I'm on the end of a... I'm on the end of the plank. And I've got the ocean full of sharks. And I better do something.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just... cracked like a thunderclap, and I had like the set of my life, and I got a ton of jobs off that. I've gotten like 4 movies off that one stand-up show.
That's incredible.
Yeah, wow. Crazy. Because of John Landis, because John Landis made me take a chance. And they were casting a TV series called Working, which Fred Savage's first show after The Wonder Years, and it was like The Office, but before The Office.
Right.
And it was sort of surreal. And so they had a role on the show of just like a guy that would just be come in to be funny. There's no character there. He was just like a joke delivery system.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie Widow's, and by that time I had started to get work as a writer and mm-hmm. things were sort of going. And they said, they want you to come in and audition for this role. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. I was mm-hmm. making money. And I was like, well, Jamie Widow's called you in. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, well, I love Jamie Widow's. He's a lovely person.
Director, also from Animal House.
Yeah, that's how he saw me, because he was at John's table. And he saw me on that show, and mm-hmm. he brought me in. And I came in and read, and there was no real character there. It was just jokes. Mm-hmm. And then I had to go test at the network, mm-hmm. and I was testing against no one. So literally, like, if I didn't get it, it would be they chose no one as better than me. The air would have been, air and silence would have given a better performance. And I got on this sitcom. And 1 week, my character was in Mensa. And the next week, he was replaced by a chimp, and no one noticed. It was just nothing. And I kept wanting to complain because I knew enough about it. I was like, this is not working. Oddly, that was the name of the show. And I was like, I can't figure out how to do this.
Right.
But I was like, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to rock the boat. I'm making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I don't want to rock the boat. And then, like, again, like, 1 week I'm crazy, 1 week I'm dumb, 1 week I'm smart, 1 week I'm not. And I'm just doing the best I can. And my parts get smaller and smaller and smaller because I'm not registering mm-hmm. because I'm not playing anything. And mm-hmm. and then it just got down to, like, you just, like, pop up out of a corner. If he knew our address, he could deliver the milk. And go back.
God.
And because I didn't speak up at the end of the first season, I got fired because it wasn't working, which I could have told them.
Yes.
I didn't want to risk the money truck going away.
Well.
So I learned a little lesson there that there's a way to say it.
Yeah.
Constructively. And now I would have gone, like, is there anything I can do to, mm-hmm. I don't feel like I'm connecting. Is it me? But at the time it was just all fear.
Right.
And I think if this, and the lesson learned is a good reflection on where we are, like, in terms of the last election. Mm-hmm. Decisions made in fear tend not to be the best decisions.
Oh, God. Yes, well, we could have seen that. All right, we don't have much time left, but I want to briefly, of course, talk about The Simpsons. The Simpsons does so many movie references.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's like, being a member of the Yankees, I would say.
Yes, it's terrifying when you start on The Simpsons.
But you started this. I'm very curious, because we're talking about process here. And, I mean, I know what it means, but you were hired originally as a punch-up guy. And explain what a punch-up guy, what does that mean exactly?
A punch-up guy is you go in and you work on jokes. You make jokes better. Mm-hmm. It is no...
So you look at a script.
Yeah. And just punch up the jokes. Make them punchier. Make them better.
But don't people get mad at you? Like, they go, well,
no,
that was...
No, no, they don't.
It was I thought it was pretty funny before
There was one guy... on the entire staff that if you think your words are precious,
yeah,
you do not belong on a writing staff.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that was great about The Simpsons was that nobody's words were precious.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired because my friend George Meyer was a fan of my stand-up,
mm-hmm.
and he heard that I was looking to become a movie star by way of being a writer. So they brought me in to punch up. If I would pitch something that was not funny, mm-hmm. they would not laugh politely.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, and the belief is, no, you're here. You're good.
Yeah.
We don't need to waste time with that baloney.
Right.
I remember one time pitching something. George is one of the most brilliant comedy writers I've mm-hmm. ever met. And we were trying to get something, and we couldn't get it. And I pitched something, and George went, yawn.
Oh, no.
But it's okay. But you're in the...
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in the... It's
you're like, just trying to be... It's like a mathematical problem.
Yeah, I know you're good. I'm not going to kiss your ass. You know you're good. You're here.
Right.
If you pitch crap, I'm going to let you know. And so I was working for a couple of months as a punch-up writer every... Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
And then at the end of like 4 months or whatever, Mike Scully, who was running the show, was a great, great guy and another truly hilarious writer, came in and said, I think your contract is up. And I was literally like gathering up my stuff like, oh, I'm so sorry. and he goes, you just want to come every day?
Aww.
And I went, yeah. And I went, all right, I'll call your agent. And then he turned and walked out and he just went, sucker. And that's... You know, I know people like it's their dream to work on that show and they write 400,000 spec scripts and it never happens. So I understand why people hate me for that story.
Well, like it says, like playing for the Yankees. I mean, yeah. Now
I always likened it to Billy, your first day there, your first kind of, you know, couple of weeks there, you feel like when Billy Preston walks in on the Beatles on Let It Be and he's going to play with them, like, okay, okay, I'll just play with you guys. What could go wrong? You know, it's like, this is horrible. This horrible feeling. You know?
And do you have a sketch? Because I always think you were sort of part of the resurgence of the show. It was on...
I guess I don't.
Well, it
goes in cycles.
Yeah, everything goes in cycles. Yeah, goes and then cycles, it kind of really hit its stride. A lot of musicality.
That was Mike Scully, and I cheered him on because Mike was a guy. You know, there's Mike is not a Harvard Lampoon guy, and he has a different sort of world perspective. Mm-hmm. And Mike is I can't say enough good about him. He's just a working class guy who loves music and loves being funny. And is, you know, we would talk for hours about how great the Ghost of Mr. Chicken is. Like he's not
nuts.
He's not snotty about comedy. Like he just loves stuff that he loves. And we were just like we realized like if we would write a celebrity that they would come. It's like, who do we want to meet? Like, let's put Elvis Costello in the show. Hey, Elvis Costello's here today.
That's amazing.
Let's meet Patrick McGoohan.
Did you have any favorites?
Well, Elvis. Yeah, I mean Elvis. He was really. Like, yeah, I mean he's 80% of my music library, and I got to meet Elvis and Patrick McGoohan was I really couldn't wait to meet.
Wow.
It was great. We were just like, because of Mike, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger were on the show. He was like, want to do the show? All right.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Were there, do you have like an episode that you would look back on as one of your favorites?
Oh yeah. Well, I think the funniest episode I wrote was the first one I wrote, which was called Homer the Moe. Mm-hmm. And it's based on my dad's life when he moonlighted as a bartender when I was a kid, and Homer took over Moe's and it was much like the bar that my father ran. And that had a really I was just like had a ton of great jokes in it and I was really happy with it. The best episode I wrote was not the funniest one. It was called Goo Goo Guy Pan, and it was when the Simpsons went to China to adopt a baby for Marge's sister, Selma. Because it was based on my experiences adopting my daughter from China. And the baby, Ling Bouvier, on the show that recurs as a character, is designed on my daughter's baby photo. I brought it into the animators and I went, make her look like that.
Aww.
And so now that daughter is 14. And she's hilarious and great. And she loves Bob's Burgers. She was watching The Simpsons, waiting for Bob's Burgers to come on. And her character, and Ling Bouvier was on. And I was like, honey, that's you. And she goes, yeah. And I go, no, that's you. I wrote the episode that character came from, and she's designed on your baby photo. She goes, yeah. It's okay, fine. Get over yourself.
Did she get the comedy genes? You know, the
my kids are there's no genes. They're adopted. She's from China. China.
But by
osmosis. Yes. I guess nature nurture. I don't know. You talk about like turns of phrase. We were in the mall a couple months ago, me and her sisters, and I snuck into a parking space, snuck it, and she's 14 years old. She went, Dad, you snuck into that space like a rat boarding a ship.
Oh, come on, that sounds just like you.
I know, I couldn't believe it. I got like thrilled. I was like, it was great.
Write that down. Write that down.
Oh,
for
we have a book. We have a book.
Oh, that's so funny. Now the last thing I was going to ask you is we were interviewing Bobcat Goldthwait, who like, again, recently, you know, starts to go back and do stand-up again, mm-hmm. and you've gone back and done stand-up again. Is it fun going back?
I mean, you know our weird connection, Bob's and my weird connection?
No.
Oh, we're very close. Right? I was,
yeah.
We started off in Boston. He was ahead of me, but I've known him since I started.
Uh-huh.
And if there's one thing that I love close to as much as I love Planet of the Apes, it's Ed Wood and that whole world.
Mm-hmm.
And years ago, I came into possession of an autographed 8x10 of Ed Wood from before he directed Plan 9 from Outer Space that has his resume on the back.
Oh, my God.
And it has, like, you know, things I've written. You know, the guy is a gal. Characters. Young sweater girl. Like, it's all there. It's all there. And it's the photo of Ed Wood that Bob has on his arm. Bob has a tattoo of Ed Wood on his arm. And it's the same photo, that sort of matinee idol picture. And you know, when I got divorced and I gave my lawgiver statue to Dean Jones, Dean Jones from Mary Lawbar. Not Dean Jones, Dean Johnson. I gave that photo to Bob Goldthwait. I was just like, I'm getting rid of a lot of stuff. And it was just two really things funny. I gave it to Bob and he was like, it was like, this will be no better place than for you.
Yes.
You can have this. And he was so moved, and we're both like, and we both say, like, it's weird that we're not gay. Like we're so, and I felt really great giving it to him. And, mm-hmm. And then Jonah Ray, who's a comedian as well, and mm-hmm. loves that stuff as much as we do, like, called me up and was like, are you okay? I was like, yeah. And he goes, you want to talk about anything? Okay. And I was like, what's going on? And eventually I got it out of him that he'd heard I gave away the lawgiver statue, and then he heard I gave away my Ed Wood thing.
He thought I was getting ready to kill myself.
Oh, my God. Well, luckily you're laughing.
I hear all these stories about people giving all this stuff away and then they kill themselves. No. And then
with comedians.
But then here's the last thing. In the way that, you know, if you give out to the universe, things come back and all the time.
Absolutely.
Since then, someone without me, you know, Bob didn't ask for the photo. I just tapped him on the shoulder and said, you should have this. And it was the right thing to do.
Yes.
Somebody gave me one of the flying saucers from Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Wow.
That they had in their, like, private museum. And mm-hmm. it was up in Seattle at that Microsoft dude's science mm-hmm. fiction museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a live read of Plan 9 from Outer Space at a local theater as a benefit. And we had a little display of props and things like that. And when I went to give it back to this person, they went, nah, you should have that. You should keep that.
Aw. Wow.
And so I have, when you watch Plan 9 from Outer Space, one of those flying saucers is in my house.
With the little, is the little string attached?
The hole, the string was attached.
Oh my God. Yeah. See, that would be the amazing part.
Yeah, the hole's there.
Well, Dean, this is so hard to I could just keep talking to you endlessly, but I'm going to...
And I could keep talking endlessly. That's the sad part.
I will. Did you have a favorite movie this year that you saw? Any favorites?
It's very difficult because most of the movies I see with my kids.
Yeah, no, you know, that's...
Like, but I'll... You know, that didn't get in the big ones. I thought A Monster Call was fantastic.
My favorite movie of the year.
Yeah, I thought that was the movie, right? Yeah,
yeah.
And that was the kind of movie that Tim Burton would make if he still tried.
Right.
I just thought that was brilliant. And I'm trying to think of
other... I agree. I thought that was a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
I've talked about I, Daniel Blake. It was a British film nobody saw.
Yeah, no. Well, nobody saw any of the movies that were nominated this year because it's very hard to get
them all.
It's very hard to get a movie made if Iron Man isn't in it. Like, you could do today, if you wanted to do an adult,
mm-hmm.
like an adult serial comic movie.
Right.
You couldn't make Bob and Carol Ted and Alice mm-hmm. today, but you could make Bob and Carol Iron Man and Alice.
To be
really, really different.
That would be a different film, definitely. Oh my God, I can't top that.
That would work.
That was so great.
You can find Dana on Twitter and on Instagram at Dana Gould, and his website is danagould.com. Yeah. Thank you, Dana.
I got in on all those early.
I noticed, I was like, oh my gosh, lucky. You can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon and in bookstores. It's out in paperback now.
You get a free copy.
Also, like our page on Facebook, check out our website, ileanaspodcast.com.
Yes, and like I always say, everyone's life has a beginning, a middle, and an end, just like a movie. And sadly, this is the end of our show, but thanks so much for being here.
I thought you were going to say, sadly, this is the end of your life.
She's selling stuff.
That would have been perfect.
No.
You know, she murdered me, but she did it beautifully.
I'm like the opposite. I'm like, I'm going to stay here just for spite. I feel like there are people that want me to kill myself, and I'm like, oh, no.
Too bad.
I'm staying here for spite.
I believe it was Richard Nixon said, I just keep getting out of bed to confound my enemies.
Oh, yes. It can be, you know.
Remember when he was the worst president we'd ever had?
I know. I can't even imagine. It's the whole...
Now he's like Roger Moore and the James Bond. Yeah, he was not so bad. Lazenby, oh, but yeah, Roger Moore's okay.
To me, it's so... You know, I've thought this all along. Just my I never talk politics, but because I love movies and film history and history, to me, this is cyclical history. I think progress has ended. Sort of progress, just that's my fear, is that if you read history... This is like, oh, yeah, this is what happened in 1692, happened in the Dark Ages, and we don't read, but that's what it sort of is to me.
It's likely there's it's a face in the crowd with a different ending.
Definitely.
And
the alternative ending.
Well, yeah, it's
the
like
one they made us shoot.
He does the, you know, the mic was off, and he became a giant, he became a bigger celebrity. Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
all right.
I know.
We're going to continue this in the green room.
Please come back. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.